Stories. There's nothing in the world more powerful than a good story. Nothing can stop it. No enemy can defeat it. And who has a better story than Bran the Broken? The boy who fell from a high tower and lived. He knew he'd never walk again, so he learned to fly. He crossed beyond the wall, a crippled boy, and became the three-eyed raven. He is our memory, the keeper of all our stories. The wars, weddings, births, massacres, famines, our triumphs, our defeats, our past. Who better to lead us into the future?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and I haven't read most of the books in George R. R. Martin's The Song of Ice and Fire.
I'm Joan Robinson. I've read every book in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, but really, does that matter anymore?
It doesn't. because welcome to our recap of the series finale of Game of Thrones. Can you believe it, Joanna Robinson, that it's happened? What is the one word that comes to mind when you think of this show being over? I can tell you mine. It is relief.
Oh my God, that was mine, actually. It really was.
It has been such a thrilling adventure to do this podcast, but it's also been very stressful, been very intense, and it's all over now. And we're free. We don't need to talk about the show anymore. No, but just...
I mean, here's the deal. We'll talk about the show again later this week, obviously. Yeah. We're doing one more episode. And I never tire of talking to Dave about anything. And I never tire of talking to you all listening about anything. The conversation around Game of Thrones has become so fraught in this final season. We just needed to like let some steam out, like let some air out of this balloon. It's just like every week was another like anguish, you know? And so I'm just like, okay, it's done. Let's keep talking about it like in a this is a thing that happened sort of way, and not a more stressful version of that as we all experienced together over the last month and a half.
Indeed. Sounds like a plan. But yeah, as you mentioned, Joanna Robinson, there will be at least one more episode of A Cast of Kings, which will be broadcasting next week. So do not unsubscribe yet. Like, this episode of the podcast is mostly going to be about a recap of the series finale. And next week's episode will be kind of a recap of, not a recap, but like a reflections on the show as a whole, reflections on the podcast. A lot of good stuff there. So definitely stay tuned in for that. But also wanted to mention right now at the top of the show, before we even get into any of the podcasts, like where people can find our work moving forward. Like, a lot of people have been asking, like, what's going to happen next because there's no Cast of Kings anymore. Again, there will be an episode next week. But after that, what is going to happen with Dave Chen and Joanna Robinson's collaborations? Here's what I'll say, and I think Joanna would agree with me, is that years happen between the things that we typically cover. Specifically, at this point, Game of Thrones and Westworld, the teaser for season 3 of which aired last night. What did you think of that, Joanna?
You know, one of the earliest podcasts we ever did was a Breaking Bad podcast. Love Aaron Paul. So yeah. Excited to see him.
Pretty bold. It felt like it was almost a completely different show than Westworld.
Oh, yeah. Well, we like to call that a hard reboot.
Hard reboot. But it was almost like a show that wasn't even Westworld. It just took place in the Westworld universe. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
But I'm very curious if that teaser represents what the show will be like, or if it's just like the first episode of the new season, and then like we're going to go back to our old ways and old characters in episode 2. In any case, you can check out that teaser online. HBO tweeted it and put it on their YouTube channel. But yeah, so I would say between like the Game of Thrones prequels and the new season Westworld, it's very possible that Joanna Robinson and I will be working together again. But the best way to know whether or not that's occurring is, number one, subscribe to Cast of Kings feed. Just keep it subscribed there. And also Decoding Westworld, which is our Westworld podcast. And when those shows roll around, if you see a new episode pop onto those feeds, it means we're recapping them. And if not, it means we're probably not recapping them. but also, follow us on Twitter at Dave Chensky is me, Dave Chen SKY. Joanna Robinson is at Joe Wrote This. And that is an excellent way of keeping track of what we're doing. But beyond that, we have existing projects outside of Cast of Kings literally right now. Like, you don't even need to wait until the next season of Cast of Kings to listen to more stuff that Joanna Robinson and I are doing. Joanna, why don't you tell them about it?
Yeah, so I've had a couple people be like, oh, I'm going to miss you so much when Game of Thrones is over. And I was like, well, guys, I do so much other work. I get it. It's different. But I'm writing all the time on bf.covenantyfair, so you can go read me over there. I have another podcast. It was actually another Game of Thrones podcast called Storm of Spoilers. We're changing the name of that because it's sort of, but the feed is the same. So just subscribe to Storm of Spoilers. We're watching Lost right now. We just started last week. It's actually really exciting. Everyone's like, a ton of people on board. We got like a bunch of new listeners because a bunch of people seem really excited to relitigate the ending of a massive series that had a controversial finale. I wonder why. So I don't know. It's time to go back. Lost, it's been a while. A lot of people haven't seen it since it first aired. It was such a huge deal and we're having a lot of fun rewatching that. So you can subscribe to Storm Spoilers, listen to me talk about it over there. My podcast Still Watching, which was also covering Game of Thrones, will be rolling on over to Big Little Lies in 2 weeks. So you can hear me talk about Big Little Lies, which is some fun political courtly sort of intrigue, over on the Still Watching feed. And then you can always hear me on Little Gold Men talking about award season stuff for Vanity Fair. So there's three other podcasts currently existing that you can listen to me yammer about until Dave Chen and I find something we can yammer about together again.
What is the name of the Lost show going to be? Like, is that revealed yet or?
Yeah, we're rebranding away from Storm of Spoilers to just The Storm because of spoilers. I think, I don't know, you, Dave Chen, are a person who does not like spoilers. So it's going to be like The Storm : A Lost Rewatch Podcast, basically. So that is the new name. But for right now, you can find us where you would find Storm of Spoilers.
Very cool. Well, I want to take this opportunity to announce a new project that I'm doing. And it's a new podcast. Basically, in my travels recently, I've been blessed to be able to have a lot of interesting conversations with interesting people, mostly filmmakers and authors and other writers on the internet. I wanted to kind of just put all those conversations into a single podcast because a lot of people, I've been putting them on like Periscope and YouTube, and a lot of people have asked me like, hey, can there just be an audio only version of this? And so I made one and you can find it. The show is called Culturally Relevant, and you can find it at culturallyrelevantshow.com where you can subscribe. There's only a trailer up right now, but if you subscribe there, there's already a bunch of stuff I've recorded that is going to go on that feed. So would recommend you check it out at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Just subscribe there. It's also on wherever your fine podcast can be downloaded. So again, Culturally Relevant and culturallyrelevantshow.com. Also, I host a film podcast called The Slash Filmcast at slashfilmcast.com, where every week I talk about movies, and also have a podcast about the writing process at writealongpodcast.com. That's writealongpodcast.com with C. Robert Cargill, the screenwriter of Sinister and Doctor Strange. So that's where you can find me. That's where you can find Joanna. And that stuff will hopefully tide you over until our next collaboration. So this podcast, let's talk about Game of Thrones. Let's talk about Cast of Kings. You can find more episodes of this podcast at gameofthronespodcast.com. You can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. And as I mentioned, we are going to be talking about the show as a whole and mostly reading your emails next week. I assume we're going to be reading a lot of emails next week. We may or may not. We'll see how the spirit moves us. So write into acastofkings@gmail.com, and it's very possible you'll have a chance to have your email read next week. But I wanted to read some emails in response to last week's episode. So last week, we recapped Season 8, Episode 5, entitled The Bells. And some people had questions, some people had thoughts on that episode. Let's start with Mike from South Bend, Indiana. Mike writes in to say the following, quote, I was very surprised no one brought up why the Army of the North just suddenly turned into murdering rapist assholes. I held my head in my hands for most of the episode, but when Danny started to torch the people of King's Landing, I thought this seems unearned. I would have been able to deal with it. But the moment when the Northern Army starts to kill innocent people, I almost just turned off my TV. The show wants to tell me that an army that doesn't like or trust the Dragon Queen suddenly starts going with the flow and following Grey Worm, the Unsullied, and the Dothraki. So now the people of the North are just murdering rapists and racist jerks. They love Jon and seem to not care about his orders to stop, making Jon Snow useless again. I'm fine to have a dark episode or even dark ending, but I need someone to get behind, and I now feel like everyone in Westeros are assholes. End quote. So, you know, he goes on a little bit, but, like, we didn't talk about the whole Army of the North turning into rapist murdering assholes last week. What were your thoughts on that scene and Jon stopping that guy that was harming this woman?
I thought it was 100% the reason that they did it was so it wasn't only brown people acting out in King's Landing.
Interesting.
There's 100% my belief. I think they were like, ooh, this is a bad look if it's just the Unsullied and the Dothraki going ham on King's Landing. Let's add some white dudes in there, too, to sort of take the temperature down a notch. So, because, yeah, I don't like the narrative either that the Northerners are pure and, like, whatever, because I think there are plenty of bad apples in the Northern Army. Of course there are. The thing beyond the fact that, like, would the Northerners just start raping? Like, would anyone just start, like, raping someone if the sky is falling? Like, is that what you do with your time if the world is ending around you? Or do you just try to leave? Like, what? I don't know. Maybe this is sticky territory to get into. Obviously it is. But, like, it just seemed like, oh, sure. This seems like the time for that. I don't know.
I actually disagree. I think that the way in which it was depicted, like, I think what that scene was trying to show is that war in general is a corrupting influence on people, and that when you're caught up in the, like, you know, one of the things that, like, most I've watched a lot of, like, DVD and Blu-ray special features over time, and here's the special feature, the Blu-ray special feature that comes to mind for some reason is the show 24 season 2. You ever watch 24, Jonah Robinson? We've talked about 24 on the show.
We've talked about 24 stuff, yeah. Before. Yeah.
And in season 2, there is a prison riot. And for some reason, you don't get to choose what you remember. And this is the thing I remember was on the special features, they were showing how they made a part of season 2 of 24 where there's a prison riot. And this, like, assistant director got up and was like, hey, like, what we're about to do is simulated violence. Right. And, like, it's going to get really intense. And if at any point it becomes real violence, you'll be escorted out of the premises. We will call your agent and you will never work in this town again. Right. And, like, it was a great, like, way of controlling the crowd. But it occurred to me just, like, in simulating violence, like, people can get carried away. See the Stanford Prison Experiment. Right. Like, whatever. Even though the conclusions of that have been kind of disproven since then. But the point being that, like, even just, like, when you're pretending to be violent, you can sometimes get too into it. So the idea that this army would be invading this place and slaughtering people left and right and then be so into it that they would then start, you know, murdering and raping people doesn't strike me as too far off the mark of, like, what humans are really capable of.
Certainly people are capable of all kinds of atrocities, and right. I don't mean to be flippant about anything. Maybe there's value in that. I also think optics play a role. So, yeah,
I don't deny that. So let's check out this email from Ron, who writes into castofkings@gmail.com. The title of his email is "I'm calling bullshit." And he writes in about people being disappointed, or he is disappointed that people have been trying to use past decisions by Dany as somehow proof that she was descending into madness or darkness. He says, quote, "We know what madness looks like. We saw it in Ramsay. We saw it in Lysa. Daenerys doesn't even come close. We cheered when Dany's brother got the Golden Crown. We cheered when she burned the slave masters in Astapor. We cheered when she released the Unsullied on their masters. We cheered at all those steps in Dany's career because we saw them then what they still are even now. Reasoned, well-thought-out, calculated steps to remove horrible leaders from power, seek justifiable vengeance, or render justice on evil men. None of these came off as madness or even rash. Men on the show have been doing shit way more dark and demented than any of those things, like Robert Baratheon sending assassins to kill an innocent young girl, Tywin ordering the full-scale slaughter of men who had come in peace, Jaime pushing a child out of the window and murdering his own cousin, also he could get back to screwing his sister, etc., etc., etc. Ron gives several more examples. Not once have we heard any of these guys be called crazy. Why? Because we all understood that in this world, that is the kind of effed up stuff you do to gain power, and probably because they're men, I'm just being real here. When they did it, they were being Machiavellian. When Dany does it, she's a crazy woman. I'm grateful there are there are passionate, well-reasoned fans and podcasters like you who see the truth that the only real madness that's out there are defenders of this abomination of an episode and the assassination of 10-year-long story arcs of characters we've come to love or love to hate. End quote. So that comes in from Ron from Framio, writing into castofkings@gmail.com. Any thoughts on that? Like, this episode kind of saw the conclusion of Dany's storyline and the conclusion of her, like, madness storyline as well. And I'm wondering, as you reflect back on it, like, how do you feel like the show told the story?
So I've been told by some folks who work on the show, and this is really confusing to me, that we're not supposed to consider Daenerys mad in these final two episodes, that it's not madness we're witnessing, but rather as that emailer articulated a sort of calculated, okay, I have to use, like, draconian, not to use a pun, fear to get
Dragonian? Okay, sorry.
Yeah, there you go. Fear to get what I want, which is, like, love is not working here in Westeros. Everyone is rejecting my love. Nobody wants it. I'll use fear to get what I want. Which took me by surprise, because it felt like, especially, like, with the main track we have for, like, Daenerys has gone mad is that previously on, that sort of, like, roundup of quotes of the madness of the Targaryens is the, like, most heavy-handed, she's gonna, you know, lose it in this episode sort of indication. And that is, like, extracurricular to the episode itself. Now, obviously, like, the people who make the show have a hand in what the previous one does, but I think that, I don't know. Like, I don't know how anyone watching at home could think she wasn't supposed to be thought of as mad in some way, but apparently that was not the intention. I don't know. Maybe we'll be litigating this till the end of time. But, like, I think what also sticks out to me, you know, Emilia Clarke has been giving a few interviews since last week's episode, and I'm trying to figure out how I feel about the showrunners not telling her where her character was headed until she got her season 8 scripts. Mm-hmm. There's maybe, like, an advantage in not tipping your hand to your actor, you know, and saying, like, oh, you know, play this, you know, they, you know, not having her lay it on too thick so that it all sort of feels like a natural evolution. But I feel like Emilia Clarke should have gotten this information at least in season 7, you know what I mean? So that she could start modulating her performance, because, like, she's performing something in these previous seasons towards a different outcome for Daenerys. And obviously, like, your current performance does not have to be exactly calibrated to where you end up. But, like, she has talked about being given directions on how to take a scene in previous seasons that she didn't understand at the time. And now she realizes they were trying to guide her here. But, like, why not give your performer all that information so she can, like, use it to inform her entire performance? And so, like, if some of these other things that happen and we're supposed to take it as a positive, victorious sort of thing for Daenerys, because Emilia Clarke is playing it as, like, a virtuous, justified thing to do, you know, yeah, on the one hand, you could argue, okay, yeah, that's Daenerys' mindset anyway. She's going to think she's right no matter what. But on the other hand, like, yeah, I just feel like I would have loved to have seen this performance with Emilia Clarke brought into the loop as early as possible.
Yeah, I agree that in general, you shouldn't tip your hand, because, like, it can become too much of the performance, right? It can become too telegraphed where the character is going. But it really does feel like they overshot it in the other direction in this case. So, agreed completely with everything you said, Joanna. But you know what's not mad, Joanna Robinson?
What's not mad?
Wanting healthy food.
I completely agree.
In your
I
body.
I completely agree. Yes.
Your body. which is something that our first sponsor, HelloFresh, can provide. Joanna Robinson, what's HelloFresh?
Oh, I love HelloFresh. HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. You know, if you are Sansa Stark and it's the start of a new day in Winterfell, you've been stockpiling all that grain. Now you don't have to give any of it to some Targaryen lady. You are going to be, like, eating fresh up in Winterfell. And that's what you listener at home could be doing as well. They send you these, like, you know, fresh pre-measured ingredients, easy to follow 6-picture recipe cards delivered right to your door. You spend less time meal planning and grocery shopping, so you can get that time back to do more of what you love, like, I don't know, getting crowned queen of the North or whatever it might be.
All meals come together in about 30 minutes and usually use less than 2 pots or pans. So minimal cleanup, really easy to do. And you can also make family dinners fuss-free with HelloFresh's picky eater, kid-tested and approved family plan recipes. We've both used HelloFresh before. I love the recipe so much. I actually like keep the cards afterwards because I'm going to use them like for other nights, even when I don't have the ingredients, because I'm just a big fan of many of these recipes. So it's a great way to teach you how to cook. It's a great way to give you food to cook. And that is going to result in some great meals every single time. So get out of that recipe rut. Start cooking outside of your comfort zone by discovering new delicious recipes. Jenna Robinson, we have a deal for our listeners, right?
For $80 off your first month of HelloFresh, go to HelloFresh.com/Kings80 and enter Kings80. That's $80 off your first month if you go to HelloFresh.com/Kings80. It's like receiving 8 meals for free.
Kings80 is the promo code at HelloFresh.com/Kings80. I'm a huge fan of HelloFresh. We're really grateful for them sponsoring us for this week. And yeah, do you have a favorite recipe, John Robinson? I think my favorite is like the chili. I love the HelloFresh chili. I think it's like one pan chili, which is like really impressive because chili feels like it should be more messy than that. But yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say there was like this stuffed chili relleno that they did that I really liked as well. Yeah, big
Amazing.
Fan.
All right, thanks to HelloFresh for sponsoring us this week. Let's move on, John Robinson. A lot to talk about today. So the episode begins with Tyrion wandering through the ashes of King's Landing. And he's just wandering and wandering, and Jon's with him. And there's you kind of see these images of devastation, ash everywhere. You see like a man just like broken down and crying. You see like another dude wandering through with his back all burned off in a fairly effective moment, I thought. And Tyrion said, you know, says like, I'm going to go my own way here. And Jon offers to send men with him, but he's like, he declines. At this moment of the show, this is like 5-10 minutes into the show, my wife, who I watched the episode with, started cracking up. And I asked her why she's cracking up, and she said, because Tyrion is going to find like some piece of Jaime or Cersei sticking up out of the rubble in order to discover that they're dead, because that's the kind of show this has become. And that is literally the exact thing that happened.
This entire episode, like the entire episode description leaked out really early. So I like knew exactly what was going to happen, like every single beat in this episode, but as early as like last week. And the one thing I spoiled for like people in my life who don't like spoilers, like you know me, I'm very respectful of people who don't like spoilers. I am of the belief, and I've heard this actually from a lot of people, that being spoiled on these final two episodes, like, help them go down easier for some people. So that's like, that's its own thing. But I had a bunch of people in my house, and I was like, can I just spoil one thing for you guys? Just one thing. And they're like, eh. I was like, I think it's pretty minor. It happens early. Just one thing. And they're like, okay. I was like, Tyrion finds Jaime's gold hand sticking up out of the roll. And they like, we were all laughed because we were like, this is the silliest thing I've ever heard. And it was very silly. It was extremely silly that he found it. It was extremely silly that, like, if you look at the scene, as many people have pointed out, like, there's no rubble like 5 feet away. So like, if
they just stood like 5 feet away, they'd be all set, basically.
They'd be fine. All of that is so silly. That being said, Dinklage is great in his grief. You know, like, how can you argue with the performance he turns in? So, like, this is just typical of the show at this point, where, like, it will bend over backwards to present you with a scenario that is completely implausible, like Daenerys on top of her dragon at the end of last week's episode. And then the actor comes in and is like, guess what? Gonna hit it out of the park anyway. And you're like, yeah, you did. You did it. So that's how I feel, like, Tyrion's anguish doesn't make up for the twists and turns they had to do to get him there, but it's a good performance.
Yeah, I mean, I think fundamentally something like that comes from not trusting the audience, is my sense, is that you can't trust the audience for Peter Dinklage to just look at the Red Keep and like understand and, you know, break down crying there. You need him to actually discover the body, or else People, I don't know, will think like they won't make the connection enough. I don't know. But it felt
there's also been some frustrating tendencies on the and this is, you know, it's, you know, whatever. It's the end. It's the last Cast of Kings episode. So I'm going to get a little acerbic, not with the show, because actually I actually liked I liked this finale more than a lot of people. So I have plenty of positive things to say. But there has been such a proliferation of terrible fan theories on legitimate outlets. This is like this has been bothering me for about three seasons now, that like legitimate outlets will publish these awful, awful, stupid theories. Sorry, stupid's a harsh word, but like theories that I don't even think the person who wrote it in the first place on Reddit like believes in. And then the outlet will pick it up and just like say, I totally believe this, when I don't even believe that that journalist believes it. They're just like chasing the clicks that you get from it. And there's ways to write about it. Like you can write about a fan theory and be like, this is why this is silly, and still get the clicks of people like interested or whatever. So anyway, there's like literally
the gloves are coming off this episode of Cast of Kings.
I'm not going to call the person out by name. There is one person though on cosmopolitan.com or whatever.
Oh, you're saying the outlet. Okay.
I will say the outlet, cosmopolitan.com, this season, every single bad theory that has been shot at me has come from one author on that website. And I just want to say, I think you are doing a disservice to the conversation around like media when you do this, because you were encouraging like some of the silliest reads of the show. And so one of these bad theories of many that I saw last week was Jaime Lannister's not really dead.
Right.
And I was just like, I don't know what to tell you. An entire castle fell on him. And so then I think that's part of why you need to show these dead bodies, is to like shut up the people who are like, okay, well, we didn't see their dead bodies, so maybe they're not actually dead. And I also believe that people watching this episode, watching Daenerys die and watching Drogon fly off with her, will for the rest of our days be like, Daenerys is not really dead, and here's why.
Yeah.
And like, that's aggravating to me. Anyway, so I know that I'm the one who says if you don't see the dead body, they're not dead, but at the same time, in the penultimate episode when a castle falls on them, I'm giving you permission to assume that they're dead.
If the castle fell on them and then you never saw their bodies again, I think you would assume that they're dead. But I understand your frustration. I agree with your sentiment, which is that writing about fan theories credulously cheapens the discourse around the show. I'm all in favor of everything you're saying. I do think that the show, to fan theorists' credit, the show has done many fake outs in the past.
Absolutely. Well, yes, but not of the same.
Right. It's not the same. It's not the same. It's not the same. But like there was that episode when like Jamie like falls in the water and it's like implied that he might die. You know, like, and so like at the end of that episode, I can, you know, it's very understandable if people were like, Jamie's not dead, because he wasn't. Basically I'm saying, because of the moves that Benioff and Weiss have made, the showrunners have made around Game of Thrones, it doesn't shock me that a lot of people are like worked up into a lather around these theories.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I'm fairly loose and easy about the theory that like most theories around Bran, because I'm like, people are just desperate for Bran to be more interesting. And like maybe they got their wish in this episode, but I think Bran is such like a weird cipher character. That's why he invited like all the craziest fan theories to crop up around him, you know? Mm.
Well, we're going to get to that for sure, Joanna. The opening scene continues. Grey Worm sentences some Lannister men to die. Davos and Jon aren't happy with these like surrendered men just being murdered. So then there's this like big kind of rally in this courtyard with the Dothraki and the Unsullied, and you see like, oh wow, like they might have lost half their forces, but there's still a lot of them left. There's a gigantic banner that was unfurled on the walls of, it looks like the Red Keep. I'm not 100% sure what that location is.
Yeah, Red Keep.
Like the ruins of the Red Keep. Really, somebody drew the short straw to have to carry that banner, you know, from Winterfell all the way to King's Landing to unfurl it there, I'm sure. Then, you know, Dany kind of has this speech where she says like, hey, we've liberated the people of King's Landing, and we're gonna keep on liberating until everyone is quote unquote liberated. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. So, I mean, what do you make of Dany's state of mind at this point?
I think she feels like she's crossed a threshold, right? A morality threshold. And in some ways, it seems like it's liberating to her. Like, she feels a clarity of purpose, a restored clarity of purpose. And you see it again when later when she's talking to John in the throne room. She just, like, she doesn't have any doubts. Any like frustrations or doubts that she's been feeling since she got to Westeros or even in back in Essos, like, seem sort of gone, for better or for worse. She's just sort of like got a shockingly clear sense of purpose and what she needs to do. And has convinced her, has talked herself into the idea that this is for the greater good. So you're looking at like someone who's bought into their own hype, their own narrative a bit too much. That's what I think. What do you think?
I mean, I think as with much of Dany's actions this season, it's been pretty confusing exactly what's going through her mind. James Poniewozik had a great Twitter thread about this morning. James Poniewozik from New York Times, television critic, and he said, I'm not sure the show ever 100% figured out what Dany did or why. Whether she was targeting civilians or killing them as collateral damage, whether she had a rationale for it or is straight up insane, and maybe they ultimately chose to leave it fuzzy on purpose. Take her Nuremberg rally speech talking about liberating the people of King's Landing by, as far as we could see, killing almost all of them. You could explain that in a few ways. Number one, she's 100% insane, which is a dramatic cheat to me, but some are fine with it. Your mileage may vary. Number two, the show actually meant to depict Dany attacking defeated soldiers, but made it look like she was targeting the defenseless. Number three, she had a tactical reason to slaughter innocents as an example, which no one ever explains. Beyond the arguments about what should have happened, etc., it's just a basic botch of what did happen. Your audience should have some sense of what exactly your central character did and why in possibly the series' most crucial scene. End quote. And I kind of agree. Like, what is she saying? Like, is she like full on nutso and like we gotta murder everyone now? You know, like, it's just not clear to me.
No, I think she feels justified in having stopped. She's talked herself into the idea, like, I was justified in stopping Cersei, like, no matter the cost, no, whatever it took, you know, stop Cersei, is equivalent to her in her mind now as like all the slave masters that she barbecued in Essos. And so she's like, we're just going to keep doing this. This is what I'm doing. I'm clearing out the bad leaders, and it'll be nothing but good leaders like me.
What about the innocents? That's the thing, is about the innocents, though. It's like, does she consider the innocent people like part of the system, right? Like,
I think she's considering it collateral damage for the greater good. That's what I think. But I agree with both you and James that so much of Daenerys is bungled in these final episodes that, like, you have to sort of gamely go along to, like, be able to track her arc. You know what I mean? You have to be, like, up for it. You're like, you know what? I'm gonna... This works. This works for me to get me where I need to go. You know what I mean? You have to do a lot of homework, I would say. And that's a failure of the show for that character. I think that show would really fail this character in the end. And that's too bad. And it seems like Emilia Clarke is very disappointed in that as well. And that's too bad, really, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, she gave an interview to The New Yorker where she said she hopes like Beyonce really loved her character. And she's like, she really just hoped Beyonce didn't dislike her at the end of the show, which is like, feels like a huge burden to carry, is whether Beyonce likes you or not. You know, like, if Beyonce liked something you did, I would be terrified of her not liking it anymore. I'm being 100% genuine. I agree. The show has done a disservice to her, and it's just really a shame how muddled that character's motivations and emotional state have been this season. When ultimately it was, from my perspective, like the primary arc of the show, other than maybe Jon Snow and Sansa Stark. Like, those were the arcs that I, like, really cared about. And I think they really messed it up in the home stretch. All that said, I do want to say that there is some genuinely breathtaking imagery in this episode.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
That scene when, like, Dany's, like, dropped off and, like, you see the dragon, like, the dragon wings expand behind her. It's brilliant. And this rally, obviously... it feels shot in a way that feels like Riefenstahl-esque. And that is also really kind of a sight to behold. The visuals of this episode overall, I actually really appreciated.
I had a new TV in my house for this episode of Game of Thrones, thanks to David's generosity of David Chen, resulted in an actually not garbage TV in my house for this final episode of Game of Thrones. And we were watching it last night, and I was like, I just kept going, oh, this is so pretty. Everything's so, it always looks so nice. So I thought the episode looked amazing. I mean, like, I've knocked the episode, the series this season for, like, too much green screen, too much, like, CG. And this is part of a function of the fact that, like, they couldn't shoot in Croatia because they were afraid of, like, drones spying on the production and, like, all sorts of stuff. So they were, like, shoved themselves into a studio and did a lot of green screen work to preserve certain secrets. And I think that shows and stuff like the Missandei execution, I think that looks, like, kind of silly. It was done on a green screen, etc. This, I think, looked incredible. This whole ruined King's Landing, Daenerys giving a speech. There were far too many Unsullied and Dothraki there, based on what we've seen of what's left of them. But that's okay. It did. It looked, yes, very Third Reich-y, very First Order, and very effective. And the way that, like, Kit Harington and Maisie Williams as Jon and Arya, and the way that Peter Dinklage as Tyrion interacted with this whole scene was really effective as well, I thought.
Indeed. Well, you know, General Robinson, if you are rallying your troops with Dragonfire, something you might need is sunglasses. Both to shield you from the bright lights and also because you can just do your best deal with it face with a good pair of sunglasses. Fortunately, that's something our second sponsor can provide you, Movement, spelled MVMT. Now, Movement's been a sponsor before, and in the past, they've primarily done watches, and we both have a Movement watch, and we both really appreciate it, right? I mean, Movement is one of the fastest-growing watch companies in the world because of their iconic minimalist designs. They believe no one should have to overpay for great style, so they're always coming out with new fashion-forward designs for you. Jonah Robinson, you have a Movement watch. What are your thoughts on it?
I love my Movement watch. I get complimented on it wherever I go. It's this, like, thick, chunky black thing, very Targaryen. And, like, yeah, it's like a statement watch. I really love wearing it. So love that. Makes me feel like screaming at a bunch of Unsullied and Dothraki about how we're going to, like, take over the world. It's great. But I'm also really excited about these sunglasses that I got from Movement. They have these, like, amazing aviators with, like, a really fun orange tangerine lens kind of thing. I don't know if orange and tangerine is on the Targaryen color palette, so maybe I'm going to get, like, booted out of the army for it. But I'm like, Movement makes such beautiful, like, the beautiful pieces that are not astronomically expensive, which I really appreciate.
Indeed, indeed. I'm also really psyched for my. Here's the best thing I can say about Movement sunglasses and watches is I genuinely don't know if I can pull them off. And what I mean by that is they are so stylish, they are so good looking, that it feels like it doesn't even feel like it should belong on my schlubby body. I think that's what's great about this company is anyone can have a piece of this luxury. Movement watches start at just $95. You're guaranteed to find something you love that won't break your bank. John Robinson, do we have a deal today for our listeners?
Yeah, you can get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to movement.com/cast. That's MVMT.com/cast. See why Movement keeps growing. Check out their expanding collection, including those sunglasses. Go to movement.com/cast.
Join the Movement. Thanks to Movement for sponsoring us today. All right, let's move on, John Robinson. What else we got on tap for this episode? So there's a lot of, like, conversations between Tyrion and like a lot of Tyrion monologues / dialogues this episode, and Tyrion and John, like, reflecting on, like, what the state of the future is and so on. But the big thing that happens in this episode is John, like, kind of getting motivated to murder the queen, right? Like, Tyrion kind of presents the situation to Jon as, like, I am, like, you have to choose what to do here because you've seen, like, how crazy Dany can be, And if you don't stop her, like, she's just going to continue torching the world and taking innocence with her. And that kind of is the inciting conversation that John needs to get up off his ass and actually do something that impacts the plot. So this whole scene of like John and Tyrion talking, because Tyrion's in jail now because he's been discovered as having betrayed the queen and freeing Jaime. What did you think of this conversation between Tyrion and John?
It's good. It was gratifying to me. You're going to have your like supremely smug moment later on in this episode. So allow me mine, which is that,
don't sound so bitter, Joe.
I'm not bitter. I just want to be like, turnabout's fair play. Yeah. 2 weeks ago, I wrote this piece about sort of comparing Lord of the Rings to Game of Thrones and talking about the ending of Lord of the Rings and how it could inform Game of Thrones. And I think it did in a number of ways. Like, I was looking at the connections between Frodo and Jon and the idea that, like, you can save a realm and not be get to be a part of it, which is sort of like what happens to Frodo and what happens to Jon. This idea of the Iron Throne as the stand-in for the Ring of Power, like, it's a corrupt, the Iron Throne itself, this metal object to the center, this iconic metal object, the center of the story, is in itself a corrupting influence. And anyone who seeks it, even someone good like Daenerys, will be corrupted by the pursuit of it. So all this stuff is in there. And one big piece of it, I think, for me was, thinking about Maester Aemon Targaryen and sort of the conversations that he had with Jon and the example that he is of a Targaryen who was meant to be king, who abdicated the throne so that his younger brother could rule and took the black. And that's exactly what Jon winds up doing, right? He follows Maester Aemon path. But so, like, my head, like, snapped up off my body when he quoted Maester Aemon in this episode. I was like, yes! Aemon matters. Thank you. So I like bringing up Maester Aemon. I liked Tyrion trying to sort of litigate the meaning of Maester Aemon's really famous line when he was like, love is the death of duty. In the books, I think it's love is the bane of duty, something like that. But it was interesting for me to hear those ideas litigated. What's harder for me to buy, I think Kit Harington is actually tremendously good in this episode. What's been a problem, and it's not just for me, it's for a lot of people that I've seen a lot of pieces written about it, is like the conflict for John is hard to buy because the show didn't do a great job of landing the John and Daenerys love story. So if you're really buying into this love story between them, then his conflict and his desire to believe in her goodness, you know, despite overwhelming evidence, would make more sense. And so the fact that Tyrion has to really convince him would make more sense. I don't have a investment in the Jon and Daenerys story. I don't really believe that he loves her. I did believe that Kit Harington was selling conflicted to me here, but like, really, it took Tyrion that long to convince you? Did you see what she just did? Like, I don't understand. And they've not been close at all this season. They had one smooch outside a waterfall, and then they've been at odds all season. So like, what are we holding on to here? Like, that, it just doesn't track for me in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I agree with everything you said. I think one of the things I appreciated about this episode is that, or in the whole John storyline as a whole, is it shows that power abhors a vacuum. Is that the correct saying? Like, basically, the whole time John has been like, I don't want it. I don't want it. And she's my queen.
Why even sitting on your Jon Snow impression for like 8 damn years of this podcast? Oh my gosh.
I know. It's I've been holding out on you. But yeah, he's been like, I don't want it. And as though that would be good enough, right? As though like, that is good. Like, he's deployed that saying as though it's going to solve all of their problems. And what he's discovered rather rudely is that that's not the case. And that his indecision, his inaction has resulted in the deaths of, you know, hundreds of thousands of innocents. At least, you know, one would think that he'd realize that. He needed this little extra Tyrion conversation to push him over the edge, I think. That is one of the messages, I think, of this final arc, is that, like, yeah, John didn't want it, but it didn't matter whether he wanted it or not. And many people tried to tell him that, and he did not listen. And people paid the price for that. So I did like that component of the episode. So then John and Danny kind of have their final confrontation. Danny enters the throne room, and it is genuinely moving when she walks into that throne room. And this, she obviously had visions of King's Landing and Ashes earlier, but like that she finally seizes the goal that she has basically been trying to achieve for the last, you know, decade in showtime, in like real time, and who knows how long in showtime. And yeah, I thought it was breathtaking, you know, that for a moment she got to touch the Iron Throne and realize her vision. Very Gatsby-esque, almost. And then, you know, has a conversation with John, and things go south after that.
It's not easy to see something that's never been before. A good world.
How do you know? How do you know it'll be good?
Because I know what is good. And so do you.
I know.
You do. You do. You've always known.
What about everyone else? All the other people who think they know what's good.
They don't get to choose. Be with me. Build the new world with me. This is our reason. It has been from the beginning, since you were a little boy with a bastard's name. And I was a little girl who couldn't count to 20. We do it together. We break the wheel together.
You are my queen. Now. And always.
So, how did you feel this whole final scene played out, Joanna Robinson?
I thought it was beautiful, right? Like, let's shout out the visuals. I thought Emilia Clarke's performance was incredibly good. And I thought Kit Harington's performance was incredibly good. I don't, I'm kind of fine with that this is how it ends. I just am not really fine with how we got here, you know? So, yeah, I like, there's a shot, there's literally, well, first of all, like, to lean back on that Lord of the Rings thing, she definitely gives the throne, like, Gollum eyes at one point. It's a thing that happens. Emilia Clarke just decided to, like, pop her eyeballs out of her head, essentially. There's also a shot that directly mirrors that vision she had in season two, where she, like, in season two, in the vision, she reached out to touch the throne and then, like, drew her hand back because she heard dragons or something like that. Her dragon baby's crying. In this, it's the same shot, but she, like, makes contact with the throne, right? So, like, yeah. she's made it. She's got there. You know, and then in his killing of her, we get this... these, like, what I'm calling, like, death tableau iconography or death tableau callbacks, because, you know, she's sort of draped in his arms, much like Ygritte was when she died in season four. So don't date Jon Snow is the lesson there, because that's how both of his relationships have ended.
Fortunately, I don't think he'll need to worry about that for much longer.
And, number two, also when he, like, lays her down on the ground, that death tableau looks to me very similar to when he was dying at the end of season five. So I thought those are some, like, interesting visual echoes. And then I just really loved, like, Drogon rolling up. We should mention there was this incredible shot that happened before this when Drogon, like, shakes off, like, Drogon rises up out of the pile of ash or snow or whatever you think it is and, like, shakes it all off. That's an incredible bit of visual work. And you really get a sense
of the scale of the dragon compared to a human in that scene. It's beautiful. It's amazing.
It's really beautiful. Yeah. And then Drogon just, like, creeping up behind Jon as he's, like, and then Drogon, like, nosing at Daenerys. And then the cry and the grief. I texted Paula Fairfield, friend of the show, sound designer, for Game of Thrones last night. And I was like, you know, because she had told me that she was doing something. She's been doing these work with, like, endangered animals, noises, and she likes using these endangered animal noises for the dragons because it's this idea of, like, they're last of their kind sort of on this planet. So using like real life endangered animals that she's captured their voices and putting them in the voice of the dragons. And she told me she was saving a whole bunch of them for something big in the finale. And I didn't know what it was. And it's this like grief cry of Drogon, where you hear, if you listen, you can just hear all these like, you know, bird like just really like anguish and the sound of the dragon, and then just torching the Iron Throne. I have, like, long before I even stumbled onto this like idea that I'm sure other people have had, that the Iron Throne is the ring of power from Lord of the Rings and it needs to be like, you know, physically meltable. Like, I've always wanted the show to end with the Iron Throne as a puddle of molten metal. Like, that was how I always wanted it to end. So I got something I very much wanted when the Iron Throne was just like gone. And this idea that Drogon, there was a funny tweet about this last night. It was like, I'm amazed that a dragon can sniff out like sociological metaphors or something like that, but can't solve a simple whodunit.
Here's one from Nimrayan Art on Twitter writes, Either Drogon is the smartest dragon in the world, as he knew the corrupting power of the Iron Throne led to Dany's downfall, or he's the stupidest and saw a knife in Dany and assumed it was the evil chair made of knives that killed her, and he wanted revenge. LMAO.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one too.
What was your interpretation? Like, why did Drogon torch the chair? Was he like, you know, bad throne, bad corrupting influence, or was he like, you know, knife chair is bad because knife go in mom? You know, like, what did you think was going on there?
The first one.
Yeah. Okay. So he's
the throne is the real thing that killed his mom, and
her pursuit of the power. You're saying, right?
Yeah. Not literally impaled her, but
killed her.
It's not that Jon killed her, you know, because we're meant to be worried for Jon in this moment, right? Is Drogon gonna like take revenge on Jon? But Drogon's like, no, it wasn't you. It was the chair that did it. Anyway, so yeah, so Drogon torches the chair and then flies off with Daenerys' body, and she's dead, guys. I feel very strongly that she's dead. So you can believe that Daenerys is alive if you want to, but I feel very strongly that she is dead.
A couple of other things I want to mention. There is this like very tender moment when Drogon like scoops her up using his little wing claw thingy, which I just thought was like a very lovely gesture. And also, there is a book callback, if I'm not mistaken, earlier in the scene when Dany says, like, I remember when my brother told me about the throne, like, it was so high that like people had to like couldn't even climb it. And like, that is, I believe, the version of the throne that exists in the books, is it not?
Yeah, there's like an old post that George R. R. Martin wrote on his live journal many years ago where he's like talking about how, yeah, the HBO version of the throne is iconic, but this is what it looked like in my mind. I think the blog post is titled like The Real Iron Throne or something like that. And I believe it's a Will Simpson drawing, though I could be wrong. And it's just like, it's insane. The throne is huge. It's a mountain. And Daenerys says something about like, you could only see the soles of Aegon's feet. That's how many like of his enemy swords he soldered together. So yeah, that was a nice shout out to George, that line.
Yeah. So then Drogon carries Dany off, and that's kind of the end of like the first first portion of this episode. Any other thoughts before we get to like the time jump? So Jon kills Dany, and like we're left not knowing what the repercussions of that will be, and I think there is like a fade to black or a cut to black, and then the next shot we see is like Tyrion lying on the ground of the cell, and he's taken out for this parlay, and you see that like all the remaining characters that we know from Game of Thrones are there. Some characters that like we haven't seen in quite a while are also there, right? So like Davos, Brienne, Gendry, Yara, the Prince of Dorne, Prince Dorne, I believe, is there. Robin is there.
Robin Arryn!
Yeah, looking pretty good, I have to say.
Robin Arryn looking great. Edmure Tully looking like he's been in maybe a dungeon for a while. Jon Royce. Yeah, and Sam is up there. The Starks have three seats for some inexplicable reason. Each of the great houses gets one, and the Starks are like, yeah, we got three, so what are you going to do about it? Did you mean my sister should kill the Night King? Anyway, And then there, what I do like about the scene is that they peppered in a few like randos in there, because they're not like all the people left alive are actors that, you know what I mean? That there are some heads of houses that we've never met before. So I liked that. What I wish they had done is like for like a nerdy shout out for the book readers is like stamp some sigils on these people. They gave them sort of vaguely, like there's one guy who's like clearly from the north because his cloak is a very northern cloak and stuff like that. But like these extra people like filling out the Great Council here are not identifiable by any house. That being said, there's someone sitting between Edmure and Sam. That when I was watching the episode last night with Neil Miller, who owns Film School Rejects, One Perfect Shot, he was like, guys, is that Howland Reed? And like, we went back and we freeze framed and we zoomed in. It was like this whole thing. I've been told that there is no confirmation either way that it is Howland Reed. Howland Reed, you might remember, fought with Ned Stark at the Tower of Joy. He's the only other person in Westeros who originally knew the secret of Jon's birth. His kids, Jojen and Mira, helped Bran get north. And Mira dragged Bran's ass like single-handedly back down herself. And so their dad, people are like, is that Howland Reed after all this time we've been waiting for him to show up? So maybe it is, maybe it's not, is sort of the answer I've been given. But yeah, justice for Mira Reed, who does not get barely a whisper of a shout out in this episode when she kept Bran safe for like so many seasons. So
indeed. Well, Joanna Robinson, I have much more to say about this scene. But before I get to that, I'd like to thank our sponsor for today, ButcherBox. ButcherBox is something that would make it easy to feed a lot of people at a large gathering, such as this one in Game of Thrones, especially if you wanted to eat meat specifically. But ButcherBox makes it easy to get high-quality meat that you can trust. Every month, ButcherBox delivers 100% grass-fed and grass-finished beef, free-range organic chicken, heritage-breed pork, and wild Alaskan salmon directly to your door. Joanna Robinson, can you tell us a little bit more about ButcherBox?
Yeah, okay. So Dave and I both got sample boxes from ButcherBox, and it was just amazing because you open it and it's just this like cornucopia, this bounty, as far as the eye can see.
A plethora of meats, as it were.
A meat deluge. You can choose from four curated boxes, and they've got all the, you know, the beef and the chicken and the pork that Dave just mentioned. Each box comes with at least 9 to 11 pounds of meat, which is enough for 24 individual size meals. So let's say you're not feeding a dragon or the Great Council electing King Bran, you can store some of this meat in your freezer. They come in individual vacuum sealed packs. It makes it easy to store, defrost when you need it. All the meat is delivered right to your doorstep with free shipping.
Joanna Robinson, do we have a deal for our listeners?
We do. For the ultimate barbecue bundle, absolutely free in your ButcherBox, plus $20 off, go to butcherbox.com/kings or enter promo code kings. That's two New York strip steaks, baby back ribs, and 2 pounds of ground beef free in your first box, plus $20 off at butcherbox.com/kings or enter promo code kings.
Just want to reiterate that is $20 off your first ButcherBox plus the ultimate barbecue bundle absolutely free by going to butcherbox.com/kings or entering promo code KINGS. Thanks to ButcherBox for sponsoring us this episode. Let's move on. So, General Robinson, I had a question about Edmure Tully, which is, he was imprisoned by Walder Frey at the end of season 3, I want to say, or season 4 might have been, whenever the Red Wedding was. I think that was season 3. And was he not freed by Arya Stark when she killed Walder Frey? Is that a thing that I just invented in my head, or did that actually
happen? Oh, you invented it.
Oh, okay. But you got to think that like when Walder Frey was killed, like Edmure Tully was okay, made it out of there okay.
So the timeline of Edmure Tully, right, is he's stuck in the cells of the twins, House Frey, and then he's dug out of there to be used as leverage to try to get River Run back from the Blackfish in season 6. Mm. So Jaime has this great scene with Edmure in a tent where he talks about launching his baby over a wall with a catapult. Mm. And Edmure basically caves and helps Jaime get, like, defeat his uncle, basically. Classic Edmure, really.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
And then they give Edmure back to the Freys. So you're right. Like, you know, substantially you're right that Edmure's then like back in the cells at the twins, in theory, when Arya rolls up to kill all the Frey men. So did the Frey women, one of whom Roslyn, I believe, is married to Edmure, set him free? Maybe, but the show never mentioned it. So who knows? But you can assume maybe that the Frey women let Edmure free once all the Frey men were dead.
Hmm. All right.
But we didn't hear hide nor hair of him since. So.
So. There is this sequence where they're kind of debating what they should do. Sansa is disappointed that Jon Snow has not been brought to the parley. And Grey, like, I mean, I have so many questions, Jonna Robinson, about like what has been going on in King's Landing the last 3 weeks, right? Like, has the Unsullied have been running things? Like, have the Unsullied and Dothraki just been like living peacefully in this, like, as a regular society, you know, what exactly is happening? But it's obvious that there's no king or queen. They say that, right? And Tyrion says, "You're the most powerful people in Westeros. Choose a king or queen." And Grey Worm's like, "Well, yeah, just make your choice, you know." And like, that's
so weird.
This is how it makes it's no decided, sense. I guess
it makes no sense. Like, I was talking to, I try not to repeat myself podcast to podcast, but I am going to repeat myself something that I said on the Still Watching podcast with Katie Rich, which is like, I really don't like the way that Grey Worm is treated in this episode. He's just like a villain basically for the rest of the series. And then he goes and retires to Noth. And I feel like there could have been some modulation. I'm not going to blame Jacob Anderson here because he's a great performer. I'm going to blame the, you know, direction he was given. There could be some modulation here of like some regret from Grey Worm over what they've done, like in the name of Missandei, or some burden of feeling in charge. Like, I would love some indication for him that he does not want to be in charge of King's Landing. Like, this is not what he asked for. Daenerys took King's Landing. She died. And now he and his army, who are like, they're fighters, they're not rulers, are in charge. And so, like, if there was some indication of that for me, then it would make sense when Tyrion's like, "You guys pick the king." And Grey Worm's like, "Yes! Pick a king. Great plan. Thank you. I did not want to do this job." So, you know, but that's, none of that's there. It's just Grey Worm like back in robot mode, which is a bummer because Jacob Anderson has been really great on the show. And I think Grey Worm deserved a better final chapter.
My friend texted me last night about this episode saying, quote, "The racial stuff with Grey Worm was terrible as usual. He has the two most valuable prisoners in Jon Snow and Tyrion, and somehow it's all the white aristocrats who call the shots while he watches. Then The Unsullied, who shed so much blood taking King's Landing, banished themselves to some island," end quote. Which, you know, there's ways to make this work, but just him saying, like, "Quiet, Tyrion," and then, like, "No one asked to hear from you," and then Tyrion then proceeds to give this extremely lengthy monologue. It's at best awkwardly staged. At best. And at worst, a disaster of a scene, which is what I thought it was. So,
I mean, I don't know, disaster of a scene. That part of the scene is a disaster, I would say. And you know, the fact that he's like, "No, you don't get Jon back. He killed Daenerys. We're going to kill him." And by the end, he's like, "Yeah, okay, nice watch." You know, like, it doesn't, like, I like Yara sticking up for Daenerys. I like that it wasn't just Grey Worm doing it. You know what I mean? Like, that Yara was still loyal to Daenerys. But then she, too, was, like, silenced really quickly by Arya. And I'm like, I don't know. This would have been, this should be much more complicated than it is. And that's just, you know, a symptom of the season, right? It's just, like, fast, fast, fast. Let's solve the problem of monarchy in Westeros in one conversation. And oh, by the way, Sansa has just asked for the North to be independent, and it's okay with everyone else, and no one else wants to be independent, just the North. Dorne, which has a long, long history of being independent in Westeros, does not make a peep. It's just Sansa gets the free North. There's a lot of silliness in the episode. That being said, there's levity here that is a welcome respite from some of the misery that we've been experiencing of late. And so, like, shout out to Tobias Menzies as Edmure for getting up and nominating himself, calling himself a veteran of two wars. Like, that's good comedy. It's an awkward swing of the tonal pendulum to it. But once it's there, I think Tobias Menzies as that character really lands it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that it's just very silly that, like, this, it just like, well, like, we should decide, let's just decide right now. It's like as though it just occurred to them. Like, it doesn't feel like this was the reason they came together today. You know, it wasn't like, we're here today to talk about the blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, we're here to try to negotiate, like, Jon and Tyrion getting free. And by the way, maybe we should just, like, pick a king. What do you think? It's just complete nonsense, in my opinion. Like, I'm stunned that this is how decisions are made in Westeros. And, like, and I already have a pretty low bar for that because I think the show intentionally wants you to have a low bar that, like, oh, it's, like, might makes right, blah, blah, blah. But, like, this is just feels so thoughtless. I was shocked. I was shocked. And that's not, we haven't even gotten to the outcome of it yet. So yeah, as you said, like, people have different opinions. Sansa pulls a Brexit, like, she Brexits Winterfell, which, I don't know if you know, but, like, in real life, the actual Brexit, like, is actually more complicated than, I think the show makes a suggestion out to be. And
the North is, I mean, that's just, that's, I agree with you that it's silly that Sansa's like, independence? Yeah? Rad. Awesome. I'm queen now. That's very silly. But I think Brexit is too, I don't know. I'll put it this way.
The idea of the North seceding and Sansa being queen of it, that feels right to me. That feels like a good outcome and a good ending, a logical ending that makes sense based on everything that's happened in the show thus far. But the way in which it was decided, with just her being like, yeah, we're going to be independent now. Everyone's okay
very
with
silly.
It. It's
very
just
silly.
So ridiculous. It's so ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think they needed Queen Sansa to help their gender optics also, right? You need Queen Sansa so that, like, Queen Daenerys and Queen Cersei being Looney Tunes aren't, like, the lasting flavor of female power the episode gives you. You know what I mean?
Theoretically, yeah. I mean, but if that's how you feel, how do you feel about the fact of what happens next in the scene, which is Tyrion giving this speech about, like, stories are actually the most important thing that makes a king? Like, the reason I'm stumbling right now is just because, like, I'm pretty sure this scene, this episode as a whole, like, really broke my brain, but particularly this scene, this idea of, like, whoever has the best story should rule. That's how we should pick a king, which, even if I agreed with that premise, which I think is nonsense, it's a stupid premise, the idea that Bran is the character in the show with the best story, on its face, feels not true to me. What do you think, Jonah Robinson?
I mean, what's interesting, if you think about it, if you go back and look at the first episode, I was doing this last night. Well, because I've been trying to, like, figure this out for a while now, because, like, Bran has been the odds-on favorite in Vegas to win the Iron Throne for, like, the whole season. So that means some, like, you know, cheating, leaking assholes went and placed some bets in Vegas. You know what I mean? Like,
disagree, Joanna. Obviously, it was very clear to people from the start that Bran would be the winner.
From at least season two. But, but that the whole story thing is hokum, but Tyrion's point about, like, Bran knows all of our history, so he knows all of our mistakes, so he can help us avoid them, and that's something that they've been seeding through the season, so I don't hate that necessarily. King Bran is fairly silly, but so I was trying to rationalize it, or trying to see if I could figure out, because George usually lays tracks on this kind of stuff, George R. R. Martin does, so I was like, okay, what tracks did he lay for us here? And there's some here and there, but, like, if you go back and look at the first episode of Game of Thrones, that's a Bran episode. Like, Bran, the show opens after you get the, like, White Walker stuff. The show opens with Bran being trained by his brothers, like, how to do archery, and then taught by his father how to be a good leader. And then they find the direwolves, and it's Bran who insists that they, like, take the direwolves home. And then it ends with Bran's fall from the tower. Like, that's... it's a Bran story. You know what I mean? And so if you're like, okay, like, let's say instead of watching the foundation myth of Jon Snow, I was watching the foundation myth of Bran Stark. The problem is the show never, like, I'm not even sure George R. R. Martin is successful at this all the way through in his books, but the show certainly wasn't in that, like, Bran is a character they had a really hard time making interesting on screen, because in the books he's so much of his story has to do with visions and dreams, and they, like, just don't the show isn't comfortable in that arena. And so Bran becomes this kind of like super boring part of the story. But it turns out he's really important. And so, like, you know, I'm curious to know when they knew that that was what George R. R. Martin wanted to do. And if they like then regretted giving, you know, Bran a season off or not, or I don't know, like Bran took a whole season off. Like, I don't know. My sense is that there is like, you would have to be like a complete stone cold genius to have seen this coming from any kind of distance. What do you think?
I think 100% agree. And it's interesting you bring that up, John Robinson, because the very first episode of A Cast of Kings was published on April 1st, 2012. And in that episode, I say the following things.
Which of the contenders? So you've got Renly, Stannis, Rob, Dany. Who would you put on the throne?
I just feel like we don't know anything about these. Like, I don't think we know anything about Stannis. I don't think we know anything about Renly, other than that he might be gay. And so really the only ones we know are Rob and Daenerys, right? And so obviously I'd probably vote for Rob because I don't know how good of a ruler Daenerys would be. Whereas Rob has shown himself already very competent at commanding large groups of people. Then again, as the show has made clear, good commanders and good fighters don't necessarily make good kings.
Correct.
So
yeah,
I think true. Who we really want to be a leader here is Bran. Clearly, they're grooming him to be the guy who's Bran is the man with a plan. If you know what I'm saying.
So as you can see, John Robinson, that was from the April episode from 2012 of A Cast of Kings, the very first episode we ever recorded, which was recapping season 2, episode 1. And I called it. I called it, John Robinson. I called the ending of the show.
I haven't listened to it yet. I'm just taking your word for it that that's what you say in the episode. I believe you. I haven't listened to it yet. I would like to listen to your tone and like how serious you sound when you say it.
Extremely.
Before I give you all the kudos.
Extremely assured. It's extremely assured. It's not at all said sarcastically.
I'm going to listen to it between now and our next episode, and then you will get the exact amount of kudos from me you deserve.
All right. That sounds like a plan. So I agree that that you'd have to be a genius to see coming. Apparently some people did, but every time I saw an article that said Bran is going to sit on the Iron Throne, I literally thought it was a joke, because Bran has some real problems in terms of like his ability to sit on the Iron Throne, John Robinson, and we will get to them.
There is no Iron Throne,
or his ability to be king and rule the land, but we'll get to them after we talk about our fourth sponsor, Simple Health. John Robinson, what is Simple Health?
So Simple Health is all about care that fits your life, making birth control simple, convenient, and affordable with online prescriptions and free home delivery. A better way to get birth control is here. So when you're trying birth control for the first time or you need to renew your prescription, Simple Health will take care of it for you. You fill out an online health profile and answer some questions to find the best birth control for you. A doctor reviews if you're a good candidate for birth control, recommends a product, and writes a prescription. Then your birth control ships to your door on a recurring schedule. No interruptions. And ladies, that is huge. It's free with most insurance plans and starts at $15 a month without insurance. Like, you don't have to go to the doctor's office to get re-upped on your birth control. You don't accidentally run out and have to miss it. And that is a huge stressor for a lot of women. Simple Health doctors can prescribe over 100 brands of the pill, as well as the patch or the ring. They personalize recommendations based on your health profile and your personal preference. I get it. You're like, I'm listening to A Cast of Kings, and why are we talking about birth control? And like, I get it. Birth control isn't easy to talk about, but we love talking about the end of Game of Thrones. We don't need to get like too personal here, but like, you know, I'll just say, as a woman in this world, a lot of people are talking about reproductive rights right now. Getting birth control is an important part of taking ownership of this whole situation. Getting birth control for the first time can be like really awkward and uncomfortable for a lot of people. And so this is a good solution for that. If you have any trouble getting your birth control, this is a good solution for that. This is a great program, a great system for you to keep on top of your own reproductive health. This service, we should say, is not a replacement for routine evaluations by your primary care physician or your gynecologist. So don't miss your chance to try the service for free. Our listeners get $20 prescription fee waived by going to simplehealth.com/kings or entering promo code kings at checkout. That's simplehealth.com/kings or entering promo code kings at checkout.
Thanks to Simple Health for sponsoring us on this series finale episode of A Cast of Kings. So here are some issues, John Robinson, to get back to the Bran situation. Here are some issues with Bran as a leader slash king. Number one, the dude has already said he's not human. He basically doesn't, like, he lacks things that humans have, like empathy, which feels like something that would be important for a leader to have. And he can't bear any children, or he doesn't, or has no interest in bearing any children, which will create some huge succession problems down the line. And it's really comical, like people coming at Tyrion with all these problems with the Bran decision, he barely wants to be king, you know, like he can't have any children. And Tyrion's like, that's actually a feature, not a bug. Like he's like desperately trying to like defend this terrible decision he's making of like, it's still good. Yeah. We don't actually want a king that has children, remember? Because that's caused so many problems in the past and so on. And I think it's just, I don't think Bran is a good choice. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, I don't know if I can defend King Bran. Life's too short for me to try.
You're not
going to
die on
this
hill? You're not going to die on the Bran hill?
No, I mean, like, it doesn't bother me, ultimately, but it also doesn't, like, actually what bothers me more is Tyrion getting let so off the hook. Like, they frame him becoming Hand of the King as, like, a punishment of sorts, and Tyrion has his, like, self-aware, I've made a lot of bad decisions. I've talked too much. I thought I was so clever. I wasn't moment here, but it still feels like he's being let off the hook way too easily for the fact that like, Daenerys snapped in a way that is not Tyrion's fault. That being said, Daenerys has listened to so much bad advice from Tyrion over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. It was Tyrion's unwillingness to lose his sister who hates him and is an asshole is why this like war was not over like in at the beginning of season 7, right? Yeah. Daenerys comes with all these ships, all these dragons, shows up in Westeros, and then just listens to so much bad advice from Tyrion as he's trying to protect his family. And it's like, bud, you're part of this problem. And he's like, I'm part of this problem. So I'm just supposed to go like, oh, okay, that's fine. You can have your dream job then. You're Hand of the King. That's your favorite effing thing to be. You love being Hand of the King. You're Hand of the King to a good king, like a nice king, not a Joffrey. So like, dream job. You just get to like sit around and shoot the shit with Bronn and Davos and blah, blah. P.S. Bronn, like I'm way more wound up about like Bronn and Tyrion. Bronn, okay. Bronn gets Highgarden. He gets the like House Tyrell, like the richest castle in Westeros belongs to Bronn of the Blackwater, who is a morally bankrupt, like ne'er-do-well. Like, are you kidding me with that ending? And I, you know, like that ending happens just because they think Bronn is funny. And then they put Bronn in the small council so Bronn could like make some funny jokes. But like that, yeah, I really do not like that ending for Bronn. I do not like that ending for Highgarden. I don't like it at all. So that's Tyrion and Bronn are the endings that bother me way more than King Bran. Who cares? Who cares who's king? Monarchy is silly anyway.
So, wow, okay. Well, I'll say I'm very bothered by the Bran thing, but, you know, I'm not bothered by all that stuff you also said. The idea of Bran being king is just, it's ridiculous, as many things in this episode are, and I found it to be completely unsatisfactory. And is there a universe in which it would have been satisfactory? Maybe. But the show certainly didn't make it out to be that way. Were you moved by Tyrion's speech about stories? Do you think Bran has the best story?
No, I mean, no. Okay. I think that Peter Dinklage as Tyrion gave a good speech. If you don't dig too deep into it, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good performance. The whole what matters is story thing is stupid. But if he had said what he really thinks, which is that, or his more interesting point, which is that wouldn't it be useful to have a king who knows, which he says, who knows every mistake we've ever made and can help us avoid it again. I mean, I don't think you need that person to be king. That person could be on your small council, but I don't know. Okay. I guess I'll ask you this. I mean, I guess I just don't care enough but to like get wound up about this, but like, I guess I'll ask you this. Who would you have appointed leader of the six kingdoms or the seven kingdoms?
If I had my choice, I would say probably Sansa. Feels like the most appropriate choice. She's the only one that feels like she knows how to rule over a kingdom. Yes. Feels like she can outwit people. Like, feels like she has the soft skills necessary and the hard skills necessary to be a ruler. Also has a great story, you know? Like, I think if you look at the stories of any of the Stark children, they are very compelling, arguably more compelling than Bran's. So even if you're using that criteria as like the measure, I would say Sansa has a good story, has good skills, is very competent. So yeah. And the idea that this guy who like barely wants it and who like has been spending the last like, you know, two seasons like completely disconnected and emotionally detached, he's going to be the guy, that's the way you're going to end this story, is galling. I thought this episode was overall a catastrophe. But Joanna, okay, what were you going to say?
No, I'm done.
Yeah. And again, we've been talking about some good things. It's not like there was no redeeming qualities of this episode, but like
of this catastrophe. Okay.
Of this catastrophe. Yeah.
All right. So then are we finishing up with a Stark family montage?
Before we get to that, we do have to mention the moment when Sam almost invents representative democracy.
And so they have the Electoral College.
Yeah. And it was pretty interesting. Like, I thought they were going to go, wouldn't it have been interesting if they'd gone that way? It was pretty hilarious. I think it was like Sir Roy says, like, should my horse get a vote? Do you remember that line? And
yeah.
I was watching the show with my wife and she said, here's the thing about that line is I don't even think that character would understand the concept of what a vote even is. And it reminds me of this scene from like Lord of the Rings when one of the orcs says they're about to like attack and he's like, it looks like meat's back on the menu. And like, there's this question of like, how does an orc even understand the concept of a menu? You know, like, has an orc ever eaten at a restaurant? Anyway.
I feel like we've talked about that before. There's voting in Westeros. They vote for, you know, we've seen them vote for Lord Commander of the Night's Watch.
Oh, that's
one
true.
Man, one vote.
I'm standing down. That is, I retract that complaint.
Okay.
And none of my other complaints. they chose Bran and I guess that settles it. Sansa pulls a Brexit. Everything is seemingly fine. Grey Worm leaves to go to Noth. Jon Snow is sentenced to rejoin the Night's Watch,
which is what he loves. So he just gets his happy ending. Go be a bachelor with your bros and your direwolf. It's fine. Yep.
He does get to say goodbye to Ghost and actually pet him, or not uh-huh. say goodbye, like rejoin Ghost and actually pet him. So in a way, the episode was worth it because he got to pet Ghost again. Then there's a couple of things that happen like at this kind of small council area. Brienne writes some fan fiction about Jaime. What did you think of this whole Brienne writing about Jaime story, like, or scene?
I think it's the only time in the episode I got truly emotional. Because, you know, I have a lot of Jaime feelings and a lot of Brienne feelings. I thought Gwendolyn Christie did an incredible job with the scene. Fair criticism I've heard elsewhere that people are like, why didn't she start her own page next? Or like, why wasn't there a mention in Jaime's entry? Like, he knighted the first woman, you know, blah, blah. I could see that being like, that's the fan fiction ending that you would want, like more celebration for Brienne, which she deserves, obviously. That's not who Brienne is, right? Like, yeah. That is deeply not who Brienne is. She is not going to start her own page in the White Book. I was 0% bothered by that sequence. And especially since that's not her last appearance in the show, right? She sits on the small council. She will have a voice in ruling the kingdom going forward. So it's not like her last scene of the show was her crying over Jaime. She was saying goodbye to Jaime Lannister. She was making good on a season 4 scene where he's like, you know, the Lord Commander fills out the book and there's still room in mine. You know what I mean? So that's a scene that Jaime and Brienne had in season 4. They paid off here. I really liked it. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I mean, it did. I think everything you said is actually right on the mark, as usual. You know, I think you're right that like Brienne's not the kind that would be really flashy, that would want everyone to know about her deal. I think it was okay. Like, it was okay with me. You know, like, it's a situation where I understand why people are bothered. Like, Brienne, this huge character, like, her ending is writing someone else's story and not her own. I understand why that bothers people. I was okay with it. I think you're right. This is, they needed a way to end that storyline, or they didn't need anything. I think this season has shown they don't need anything. But, like, a good way to end that story would have been some kind of closure between Brienne and Jaime, and like this was the way they provided it, and I think that was fine. So no major beefs with that part. But there is a scene that happens next where they put this book in front of Tyrion, and it says, "A Song of Ice and Fire." I think in the past we have predicted that this might happen.
Yeah.
And now that it has happened, what are your thoughts on it? That we've been watching like this book the whole
time. I think you want something from me on this episode that I can't give you, which is to share in your like,
no, that's not true.
In your like incredulity and despair. But like, what I'm going to tell you is that I emotionally checked out of Game of Thrones several episodes ago. So like, I guess I feel like incapable of getting wound up. Like there's just been so much nonsense this season since episode 2. That I'm like, I don't have the capacity to get like shocked anymore. So I'm like, yep, that looks about right for this show. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. John, I do not want something that you don't, I do not want anything but what the actual Joanna Robinson opinion is.
Yeah. So they set it up in season 7 and they knocked it down in season 8, which is, you know, so yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just say, I think it was deeply silly that this is the book version of what we're reading, and then it's the title of the book. It's like that, you know, scene from Back to the Future 2. It's like, it's your cousin Marvin Barry. I have this great new sound you've been looking for, kind of thing.
That's a Stone Cold classic line, though.
Yeah, it's like this lame version of that. It's like super on the nose, you know? Or when it's just so, it's like a sledgehammer, you know, on the nose. And then they kind of have this small council meeting, which there's, you know, there's like chair funness, like, oh, hey, look at the chairs. Like I arranged the chairs and now they're all messed up again. Hilarious. But one of the things I liked about this scene, I don't know if you saw this from Patton Oswalt tweeted this last night. Did you see this? He says here, the most hopeful scene from last night's Game of Thrones finale was the table discussion near the end. Sanitation, construction, boring civic concerns that make life 1,000% more livable. That's how it's supposed to be. That's why you step up to govern. I really hope we mature past this governing by personal drama and vengeance that, while entertaining, is unlivable. Banking, government, and police work should be boring. That's the sign of an evolved society. Quietly planning, anticipating, and getting it done. And I actually agree. Like, on reflection, that scene of them like arguing over whether they should have brothels and stuff is this show's version of Parks and Recreation. And once you've moved past, like, I don't agree with any of the things that it took to get to this point. But once you've moved past the let's kill people indiscriminately and, you know, vengeance for vengeance sake and eye for an eye makes the whole world go blind, et cetera. Then you do need to get to governing. And that's kind of what this scene shows, I think.
Yeah, there's this great quote that George R. R. Martin gave Rolling Stone. I think it was back in like 2004, where, you know, he talked about a lot of he was a great interview. If you've never read it, he talks like very openly about a lot of the themes that he wants to address in A Song of Ice and Fire. And this is one of my favorite Martin quotes of all time, and I come back to it year after year when I've tried to figure out what the ending of this show is going to be. He says, Ruling is hard. This may be my answer to Tolkien, whom, as much as I admire, I do quibble with. Lord of the Rings had a very medieval philosophy that if the king was a good man, the land would prosper. We look at real history and it's not that simple. Tolkien can say that Aragorn became king and reigned for 100 years and he was wise and good, but Tolkien doesn't ask the question, what was Aragorn's tax policy? Did he maintain a standing army? What did he do in times of flood and famine? And what about all those orcs? By the end of the war, Sauron is gone, but all the orcs aren't gone. They're in the mountains. Did Aragorn pursue a policy of systematic genocide and kill them, even the little baby orcs in their little orc cradles? In real life, real-life kings had real-life problems to deal with. Just being a good guy was not the answer. You had to make hard, hard decisions. Sometimes what seemed to be a good decision turned around and bit you in the ass. It was a law of unintended consequences. I've tried to get at some of these in my book. My people who are trying to rule don't have an easy time of it. Just having good intentions doesn't make you a wise king. I think about Aragorn's tax policy all the time since I read that quote. And when this small council scene started warming up, and you see them talking, I was like, oh, they're doing Aragorn's tax policy. Like, it felt like really honoring this thing that George R. R. Martin cared about. And I really liked that was in there.
I agree. That was a touching moment. Also, we got to see Podrick is a knight now. And that's nice, right?
If you're in the Kingsguard, as Podrick and Brienne are, allegedly have taken a vow of chastity. I think that's true for Maesters as well, right. As Night's Watch. So in theory, Sam and Jon and Pod and Brienne are all off the market. But I say in a new Westeros under good King Bran, you know, vows of chastity are off the menu. Meat's back on the menu. Vows of chastity off the menu.
Nice.
Boys.
Callback. Yeah. There is a montage of all the Stark children that is legitimately beautiful. Arya is going to find whatever's west of Westeros. Sansa goes and rules the north. Sansa's outfit, freaking spectacular, right? Oh, the weirwood, like lining or whatever it is, like the little leaves under her.
Embroidery.
Yeah, embroidery. Yeah. That's what I'm looking for. Thank you. That's the word I'm looking for. And then Jon donning his Night's Watch outfit to go back. We got to talk about Arya, John Robinson, which is like earlier this season, you know, you said, hey, like if this season, you know, please correct me if I got this wrong, but you said something along the lines of like, if this season ends without reckoning with like Arya's past, then we can talk about it and I will eat crow or something along those lines. If I've mischaracterized that, please correct me. But like, also, what did you think of the whole Arya storyline ending this way?
Reckoning with her past is in like she needs to pay for her murderous ways.
Not even pay, but at least like, did that impact her at all? You know,
I think this idea, that's what we saw in last week's episode. Like I was pretty resistant to this. Like, so like I said, I knew a lot of what was going to happen. The finale, I didn't know how Daenerys died. Hand to God, I did not know if Jon Snow was going to kill her or if Arya was going to kill her. Cause I believe they filmed multiple endings. So I didn't know. And so when a lot of people were like, well, obviously the reason why Arya got on that white horse at the end of last week's episode was pale horse, pale rider. She's become death, blah, 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 blah. So she's going to go kill Daenerys. And I was like, ooh, hate that, because isn't the whole point of what happens in the Bells for Arya and Sandor is he teaches her not to pursue vengeance killing. And so you guys are rooting for her to just then turn around and vengeance kill Daenerys for what she did. Like that's, I mean, maybe that's not vengeance killing. Maybe that's justice killing. But I was like, no, that sounds bad. What I would like from that exchange between Sandor and Arya in the last week's episode is that she puts her murder list away from good for good and pursues like chases life instead, chases life experience, not death. And that's, I feel like what we got in this episode. Do you feel like, it seems like you think that she's too unclouded by the violent things that she has done. And maybe that's the case. Maybe it's too much of a facile ending, but this idea of Arya looking for what's west of Westeros feels like a really hopeful ending. And it's a, you know, it's obviously like a callback to the season 4 finale, The Children, when she gets on the boats for Braavos.
Same, similar music too. Like they use a similar kind of.
They use the choral version of the theme and she's sailing off and stuff like that. So I like that because that's one of my favorite Arya moments, even though I didn't like what happened when she got to Braavos. Like her leaving Westeros is such a cool moment in the series. So for them to bring that back and this montage of like Sansa, Arya, and Jon all taking their positions, I thought was I mean, I don't know that I thought this episode was spectacularly shot. This is directed by Weiss and Benioff, who are not usually the directors of Game of Thrones. I think they've done two other episodes. I wasn't like dazzled by any of the direction, but I did like that series of shots between the three of them. But it sounds like you wanted something more for Arya.
I think that it would have been great to just... A lot of people have questions about what was the whole point of training a whole season in Braavos? Was it so that she could get the drop on the Night King? What was with the whole like switching of faces? Like that didn't seem to play a role in the final episode, unless you believe she used a face to like get close to the Night King, but that was never explicitly shown. Like as we get to the end of it, it's kind of like, what was the purpose of all that? You know, and I don't know that that was clear. I think that the idea of Arya never feeling at home and being like a nomadic person and walking the earth feels right to me. That feels right to me. But it's framed as triumphant at the end of this episode.
And I think it's framed as hopeful.
Yeah, and it just feels unearned to me. It does not feel like her being a nomad and whatever. That's great. That makes sense. But like it being hopeful or triumphant or like this is everything is right with the world. That just doesn't feel like the right ending for that. It doesn't feel like the show earned that ending. In any case, I didn't like that. The only question I have for you as we wrap up here, Jenna Robinson, is like, what is exactly going on with Castle Black and Jon going north with the wildlings? Is Castle Black even necessary now that the Night King army has been defeated? What is happening with Jon up north? Like, and is he going on an away mission or is he like literally going north forever? Like what is happening at the end there in your opinion?
I like that away mission thing. Yeah. To me, like it's ambiguous, right? There's a couple things going on. Number one, I know this isn't quite what you asked. I'll get to what you asked. There's some nice like echoing back shots, like the very first shot of the series is that gate coming up on the three Night's Rangers ranging north.
Yep.
And so you get that again with Jon and Tormund, right? And you get this little bit of green coming up from the snowy ground. And that's obviously, I think, a feint to the fact that George R. R. Martin plans to call his last book A Dream of Spring. So this is A Dream of Spring that we're seeing right here. And then this is Jon making good on, this promise to make sure that the wildlings have a home. I think Jon, I mean, he's in his Castle Black, he's in his Night's Watch Blacks again, but I think it seems to me like he's ranging true north, because Dorman's like, you've got the north in you, the real north, right? I think he's ranging true north with them, and I don't think he's coming back, given the look over his shoulder that he gave. That being said, like he kind of tried to get a bunch of people to visit him at the wall, so that'd be a real dick move of him, you know? Like Tyrion's gonna go up there trying to see him, and like Queen Sansa would want to visit, you know? Like, so I guess it depends like how much Jon wants to cut ties, but maybe it is just an away mission to try to relocate the free folk who were displaced by the Night King, get them settled back at like Hardhome and the various other places up north of the wall before heading back, you know? Cause he's got his Castle Blacks on. And there is a line in the episode where he's like, is there even a Night's Watch anymore? Like he says that. So like the show at least slightly acknowledges like, why do we need this if we don't have the Night King? Yeah. But, I should point out that in the books, there's not just the White Walkers. So there's Snarks and Grumpkins and Ice Spiders as big as hounds and all sorts of stuff allegedly north of the wall. So you never know. You never know what other.
the wall might be keeping out other forces, right? Although that's not spelled out in the show. But
no.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes sense, I guess. And that basically brings us to the end of this episode. So like we have much more to talk about. Not today. We'll do it on next week's episode. We have much more to say about like this episode, its legacy, the legacy of the show, its impact on our lives, all that kind of stuff at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. But like closing thoughts on this finale, and specifically, I'm curious like how you think this measures up with other finales of prestige television shows.
I will just say that this left me with a better taste in my mouth than the last three episodes of Game of Thrones left me with. So like, I guess maybe I'm feeling the effects of that. Like this is better. This was better to me than some of the frustrating logical fallacies that we've like experienced earlier this season. So I actually like am more positive on this episode than some. And maybe it's like, once again, maybe it's because I was spoiled. And so I knew that King Bran was coming. So I like wasn't being like, what, King Bran? I was like, oh, Robin Aaron looks nice. Like, you know, that's where I was as well watching this episode. So yeah, like, I don't know, maybe I've just done a thing where I've just emotionally I'm not emotionally detached myself from the fandom of Game of Thrones, because I still care so much about that or our conversations. But I think this show has just become a completely different animal that, like, I don't even know that I think of it in the same terms I would think of a Breaking Bad or a Mad Men or you know, a Sopranos or something like that, or Justified or whatever, where I was like in it until the end. I, you know, what became clear when they started their final two season sprint was that, you know, we were just going to get what we were going to get. And maybe the real finale, you know, my thesis is that the real winner of Game of Thrones is George R. R. Martin, because everyone now wants to read those books. So we'll see.
I'll just share a few closing thoughts, which is like, I thought this episode was hugely disappointing, that the idea that Bran is the king and that, like, the way all these storylines wrapped up, very difficult to do. I don't envy the show runners, but even everything leading up to this was a disappointment. And we've talked at length about why that's the case, about why a lot of character motivations didn't make sense or were unclear, about how the show had no time to breathe. I think that the decision to make these two shortened seasons, which I have to think is a decision made by the showrunners. I have to think, like, with no internal knowledge, I have to think that, like, they had the option of making longer seasons, they had the option of making more seasons, they had the option of handing the show off to other people. They refused those options. This is all just speculation on my part, but I think it will go down as one of the biggest mistakes in television history. And this unfortunate conclusion is the result of that.
I think it's all, but it's all a piece of, like, I wrote this essay for VF.com that you can go read that it has some pieces from the original show Bible and pitch letter that Weiss and Benioff sent HBO. And in it, they talk about what their hopes for the show are. And a lot of what they were pinning their hopes for the show on, and these guys had never made television before, right? Maybe this is best served for our later episode, but, like, I will just say briefly, and maybe we can go into it a little bit more depth on our next episode. But they're pinning a lot of their hopes on the fact that George R. R. Martin had written 4 books by the time they first pitched HBO, and he published a 5th book, you know, between that time and, you know, and the same year that Game of Thrones premiered, Dance of Dragons came out. It was reasonable for them to expect that George R. R. Martin would finish his books. And if he had finished his books, they would have gone on with their role, which was adapter. They are adept adapters and not so much creators. And so they set out with one job that they thought they were going to do, which is adapt this fantasy series that they really loved into a TV show. And then halfway through, basically, they're confronted with this reality that this roadmap that they thought they were going to have, they're not going to have. And now they have to figure out for themselves. So what do they do? You know what I mean? And did they make a lot of mistakes along the way? Absolutely, yes. But I have some empathy for the fact that this was not their plan. So, yeah.
Well, and let me just say this. I mean, we'll talk more about this next week as well. But that ultimately, despite how badly this all has ended, it has given us a lot of good times in terms of this podcast.
Absolutely,
and the people
yeah.
we've met. And we'll talk a little bit more about that next week. But in my opinion, this show has at times been great art. And I think only great art can get people talking, can get people taking it seriously, can get people speculating and analyzing as they have for this show endlessly. And it can get a show growing its audience season over season, which is what the show has done. And so despite how disappointed I am with the last two seasons, and in particular the last like 3 episodes, I am grateful for the show and what it has given to our culture and you know, to us in the form of this podcast. So we'll talk more about that next week. But I think that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of A Cast of Kings. Find all the rest of the episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. Email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. We'll be going through a lot of your emails next week. Joanna Robinson, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
VF.com. You can hear me talk about Lost on Storm of Spoilers, or you can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
Find me at DaveChen.net and check out my new podcast at culturallyrelevantshow.com. You can subscribe wherever your podcasts are downloaded. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.